Saudi Arabia sentenced 14 Shia people to death. They're charged terrorism. They were convicted of attacks on police in the Shia-populated area of Awamiya in the eastern province, scene of past anti-government protests. Just like a previous death sentence, a prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, which was eventually mixed with the ones that were issued against al-Qaeda terrorists. Now, in this edition of The Debate, we'll discuss why the Saudis are issuing death sentences against Shia Muslims and whether their enmity towards them is justified.
Saudi Arabia is pressing ahead with its heavy-handed crackdown against the Shia population. On Wednesday, a criminal court handed down death sentences to 14 Shia Muslims. The court also gave long jail terms to 9 other detainees. The suspects have been accused of taking part in terror-related activities, including carrying out attacks in Qatif area of the eastern province. The cases relate to protests against the Saudi regime between 2011 and 2014. The popular uprising was quashed by the Saudi security apparatus. This is not the first time the kingdom's treatment of its Shia citizens has come under media spotlight. Earlier this year, Saudi authorities executed prominent Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr on similar charges, sparking international condemnation. Experts believe the latest death sentences are part of a larger trend of the Saudi crackdown on its Shia population.
This is, of course, an outrageous step and move by the regime of the Saudi Arabia, because they are aware and they know that these people have not committed any offense. It is persecution of that knows no bounds in dealing with the population of the Arabian Peninsula.
Saudi Arabia is a kingdom in the Middle East with a population of roughly 30 million people. Nearly 10% of them are Shia Muslims, mostly living in the oil-rich eastern province. They frequently complain of systematic discrimination and marginalization. Riyadh has repeatedly been accused by rights groups of violating their rights, but analysts believe it has managed to brush aside international criticism through the support of Western countries.
The problem is that these regimes are supported. They are only there because of the Western support. So when these regimes carry out executions or kill their own people or sentence people like Sheikh Ali Salman to jail, these countries in the West come to their own, to their aid. They support them politically.
The list of Saudi violations is long and bleak. Its treatment of women and minority groups, war crimes in neighboring Yemen, and support for terrorists in Syria and Iraq are just some of the rights violations of the royals in Riyadh. And yet the kingdom's right violations have continuously been ignored. Should the international community continue to turn a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's rights crimes?
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison. And U.S. Foreign Policy and National Security Analyst Lawrence Korb joins us from Washington. Gentlemen, welcome. Lawrence Korb, let me start with you. You have these 14 Shia people who have been sentenced to death. They're charged terrorism. They were convicted of attacks on police in the Shia-populated area of Awamiya in the eastern province. Do you think that this sentence is politically motivated in any shape or form?
Well, first of all, let me say I think the death penalty should be abolished worldwide. The Saudis are on a pace to execute more people this year than they did last year. Last year, they executed 158. In January, they executed 47 people. 43 of them were Sunnis. So I think in terms of their, you know, executing people, they don't seem to distinguish between the different sects. They, in my view, they, you know, do it too much. And I've got to say, since, you know, we're, you know, from Tehran, Iran last year executed over 1,000 people per capita, the highest in the world, second only to China in the total number.
Well, when we look at the offenses, though, Kevin Barrett, that Lawrence Korb is talking about in terms of Iran, many of them, if not most of them, are drug-related offenses. They're not Saudi Arabia has passed as a counterterrorism law, for example, that pretty much can put anybody in jail for just expressing their ideas that they deem that goes against the regime there in Riyadh. Kevin Barrett, this sentence sounds a lot like what happened when Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, prominent Shia cleric, was sentenced to death, and eventually he was executed, mixing up with some terrorists. They have terrorists that they say were rounded up from the year 2011, al-Qaeda ones. Back then, al-Qaeda was not really a factor. What is your take on this sentencing by the regime in Riyadh?
Well, you know, the problem isn't so much just that these are executions, whatever one's position on the death penalty may be, but the problem is that Saudi Arabia executes and, of course, tortures, imprisons and brutalizes people, not for committing anything that anyone in the civilized world would consider crimes, but for participating in dissident political activities. And that's not happening in Iran, and that's not happening in most other places that execute people. So this is a special case. Saudi Arabia is recognized by a couple of human rights groups as the worst of the worst. That's a direct quote from one of them. But the biggest ones, which are funded by the big foundations, the biggest banks in the world that are in bed with Saudi Arabia, as it props up the Rothschild petrodollar, which is essentially the instrument used to rule much of the world, the Saudis are generally given a free pass. And indeed, that regime would never have lasted very long if it weren't being constantly propped up by the Western powers. So we have here a case of extreme hypocrisy. The West pretends to stand for human rights, democracy. These are the values that we're supposedly fighting for all over the world. But in the Islamic world, the West is propping up this most brutal of regimes, most retrograde of regimes, a regime that up until not very long ago was maintaining half of its people in poverty and actual illiteracy. That's right, the literacy rate in Saudi Arabia, not so long ago when I was finishing my PhD in Arabic and Islamic studies, I believe in the 90s, was close to 50%. And this is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Their misbegotten oil wealth is being squandered on gambling junkets and other really exorbitant and decadent activities. And so these people are very vulnerable to those citizens who recognize that they're being misruled. And for that reason, the regime in Saudi Arabia has had to be incredibly brutal in its repression of any kind of opposition. Additionally, there's a special animus against the Shia. I don't know what the figures are for executions, but we do know that the Shia population in Saudi Arabia is very severely repressed. There's not a single Shia police chief, even in the Shia regions that are almost 100% Shia. There's not a single Shia person in a cabinet-level position in Saudi Arabia. Have been these kinds of crackdowns going on and on and on. So these people who are slated for execution are very likely not anyone that would be considered a terrorist anywhere else in the world. They're people who are essentially human rights activists.
Well, Lawrence Korb, why is it that Saudi Arabia looks at Shias in that form? I mean, they pretty much, when you take a look at what's happening in Al-Awamiya in the eastern province, they are marginalized completely. Even the area itself, it's like ground zero of a largely forgotten corner of what I'm reading here described by Foreign Policy. This was during the time the so-called Arab Spring was happening, and how Saudi Arabia is marginalizing these Shias. Sounds a lot like Bahrain also, but why is it that Saudi Arabia looks at Shias in that way?
Well, it's unfortunate that they discriminate against the Shias, because the Saudi ruling people see themselves as the guarantor of the Sunni version of Islam. And it's rather unfortunate that in the Middle East, this Sunni-Shia divide has come into play. And I think we need to deal with that. I agree that, you know, executing people is not going to do it. And I wish, as I say, that all of the countries in the world would stop executing people. In the United States, last year we were down to 26, and one of our three remaining candidates, Senator Sanders, wants to do it away completely. So I think that would be the first step. And then I think that the whole question of the Sunni-Shia divide is something that the people in the region really need to begin to work out among themselves. Hopefully, if we can get the Syrian civil war stopped and focused on ISIS, then we can move on dealing with the Sunni-Shia divide. I think once, if we can ever get the terrorist threat under control, that's going to be the big challenge for the people in the region.
Well, how do you go about that, Kevin Barrett, when you have extreme views coming from Saudi Arabia when it has to deal with Shias? I mean, we're looking at this hardline elements in what many are saying is a Salafi establishment. You're looking at the regime there where they're promoting sectarianism practically, looking at how they're dealing with the Shias in, for example, Awamiya. How can that be fixed?
Well, I do differ with Mr. Korb on a couple of these things. One, I would not say that the Saudi regime considers itself, much less is considered by anyone else, a guarantor of Sunni Islam. On the contrary, they're a guarantor of Wahhabi Islam, which many Sunnis would not recognize as anything very close to what they think of as Islam. The reality, though, is that in Islam, normatively, all of the major law schools are considered to be within the mainstream of Islam, and that includes the Jafari Law School, the main Shia law school, whose founder, Imam al-Jafar, was very, very, very respected and is still respected by virtually all Sunnis. So what we have in Saudi Arabia is not a sort of a Sunni state. What we have is an extremist state that's sometimes been called Takfiri, or it's under the influence of people that could be called neo-Kharijites. The Kharijites were radical extremists of the early days of Islam who essentially walked outside of Islam by pronouncing everybody else, all the other Muslims, as not being Muslims. And the history here is that the Ibn Saud family's ancestors were bandits who murdered and robbed pilgrims en route to Mecca. They were warlord bandits, and they made an alliance with the these radical Wahhabis. Well, Abdul Wahhab, the founder, who was a religious fanatic who essentially wanted to kill every Muslim who didn't see things exactly the way he did. So these bandits who made their living robbing and killing Muslims, the Ibn Saud family, hooked up with the Wahhabis, who were actually probably these heretical Jews from Turkey. And these two groups have been preying on Muslims ever since. So let's not get this so-called Sunni-Shia divide is large. There's some reality to it, but what we're seeing today is completely out of control, and it's been artificially manufactured by these very corrupt forces. They essentially freaked out in 2006 when Hezbollah defeated Israel. The Sunnis all over the world were cheering. And the Zionists and their friends in Saudi Arabia said, we can't have this. We need to start seeing to it that the Sunni world no longer supports Hezbollah. This is a threat to Israel. So they immediately began spending billions of dollars on public relations propaganda and perhaps subliminals even, every means that they have to try to stoke sectarian hatred in the Islamic world. It's one of the biggest propaganda operations in history. And unfortunately, there are Sunni people in the world who are falling for it because many of us Muslims are just not very well educated in our own history and our own faith.
Lawrence Korb, unless you have a reaction to Dr. Kevin Barrett there, what was your reaction when you heard about Saudi Arabia executing a prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, knowing how popular he is and knowing Saudi Arabia, knowing that his execution would bring about lots of tensions in the region, of course, tensions with Iran included in that?
Well, as I mentioned, I think the death penalty is wrong, and I think this does not seem to be justified on the basis of the conduct. So yes, I was appalled and recognized that this is not going to help the situation in that part of the world. And I think the United States has been increasingly critical of the Saudis. President Obama, if you read his interview in The Atlantic, basically has criticized them. In fact, when he went to Saudi Arabia the last time, they had some minor official meet him. So the United States is beginning to recognize that they have to speak out when the Saudis overstep their bound to do things that we don't like. One of the problems the United States has faced is after the end of the Cold War, we tried to transform society, and it doesn't work. I'd like everybody to have same freedoms that I do and the same ability to speak out and challenge the government and challenge other points of view. Unfortunately, that's not the way the world works. I think one of our problems right now with the United States is Turkey, which has been a member of NATO, and Erdogan is beginning to crack down. We're working with them just as we're working with the Russians to try and get the Syrian civil war stopped so we can all focus on ISIS. And during the Cold War, we got ourselves involved with a lot of countries to deal with what we thought was the greatest threat, which was Soviet communist expansionism. Were those countries all perfect democracy? No, they weren't. I mean, in World War II, we allied ourselves with the Soviet Union to defeat Hitler. So, yes, you have to make those compromises as you deal with things in the world. The United States, the agreement that President Obama and the P5 plus one made with Iran has been criticized by a lot of people who do not like the way the Iranians are running their government. And they looked at the recent election and they thought that what, quote unquote, the moderates should get more power. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like that.
Well, if you want to talk about the U.S., Dr. Barrett, let's look at the execution of Sheikh Nimr. And I'm looking at the way that the U.S. actually reacted to that. Won't forget how John Kirby, at that point, appealed to Saudi Arabia's government to respect and protect human rights and to ensure fair and transparent judicial proceedings in Saudi Arabia. Now, how could the U.S. say that, knowing the way that the Saudis run their judicial system, knowing that people can get arrested just for pretty much showing or revealing their thoughts on the streets, and if it happens to be against the government or the regime, then they get put in jail?
Yes, there does seem to be a extreme element of hypocrisy there, doesn't it? I think when the American leaders make these little remarks sort of chiding the Saudis and other friends who are human rights abusers, this has to be taken with a grain of salt. It's really public relations fluff, because if the United States government really disagreed with these gratuitous human rights abuses of the Saudis, then we wouldn't have U.S. advisors helping the Saudis mass murder people in Yemen with British manufactured cluster bombs. At the very least, we would be stopping that. I mean, that's one of the worst human rights abuses that the Saudis are committing right now, and the United States is a co-conspirator in this mass murder of the people of Yemen. So I think the deal has been, ever since 1945, when Roosevelt met with Ibn Saud, that the Saudi royal family is allowed to loot, pillage, and plunder, run around the world on their Learjets, spending billions on their sybaritic pastimes. As long as the Saudis prop up the petrodollar, or rather prop up the world financial system, and allow oil to be priced in dollars, indeed mandate that oil worldwide be priced in dollars, forcing every country to stockpile dollars, this is what keeps the dollar afloat. Since Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard in 1970, there's been no reason for anyone to think the dollar is worth more than toilet paper, except for the fact that the Saudis, having the biggest pile of oil on the planet, have essentially forced the world to use dollars to buy oil. So as long as the Saudis keep doing that, then they will be allowed to run rampant all over their own people and all over the people of the region.
Well, Lawrence Korp, it's always been a big question mark, and I think maybe Dr. Barrett has a point there. There's petrodollars and oil that has made countries, Western countries in particular, I guess, trying to go against Saudi Arabia or try to tolerate its actions, knowing that how severe it goes against human rights, the kingdom of which, as you mentioned, executions abound, and a regime that doesn't even allow women to drive. Is it just because of the petrodollars and oil that Saudi Arabia is being tolerated?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that it was the Saudi oil that got President Roosevelt on the way back from Tehran during World War II to meet with the Saudis, and we needed the oil. The Saudis were basically, when I was in government, pumped a lot of oil, which helped us bring the Soviet Union to heel because they're an oil exporting country. We're not as dependent. We're becoming more and more energy independent, and I think that's why that we're speaking out, and as I say, with President Obama openly criticizing the Saudis. But foreign policy is always about making choice between your interests and your values. I mean, as I mentioned, we could go back. Stalin was executing millions of people. We allied ourselves with him in World War II in order to beat Hitler. When Nixon went to China, they were just finishing the Cultural Revolution. They were sending arms to Vietnam to fight Americans, but we wanted them to balance the Soviet Union. So those are the choices that you make in foreign policy. And basically, I think where you have to be careful, and that's why I support when you mentioned Admiral Kirby's comments about the Saudis, you can't have it both ways. You should speak out when they cross the line, which he did. Now, and I think we're finding we're getting, you know, tougher and tougher on them in terms of, you know, our dealings with them.
Well, let's go back to Kevin Barrett, the Al-Awamiya district in the eastern region of Saudi Arabia. That represents roughly about 15% of the population there, and they're looking for greater political and economic rights. They're looking for equality, generally speaking. And of course, those are the things that Saudi Arabia is not allowing them to have. And I mentioned before, this sounds a lot like what is going on in Bahrain regarding how the population there, the Shia ones, are being marginalized. Is Saudi Arabia at all concerned about them rising and affecting the kingdom, or are they going to keep that region the way it is?
Well, I think the Saudis, of course, are oppressing these people within their own borders, not just Shia people by any means, but the people who are essentially economically deprived have really never had a share in power and wealth in this incredibly powerful and wealthy kingdom. And the ruling family is scheming and pulling all of the strings to try to keep it that way. And what's really sad about this is that it's so against all of the spirit of Islam, which is a very, very egalitarian faith that says that all people are equal, and the only thing that distinguishes one person over another is their degree of piety and good works. And there's a long history of the Islamic world having these, you know, these fights. The early days of Islam in what's now Morocco and Islamic Spain, the Berbers rallied to the Shia banner as a sort of a protest against the fact that they were being treated as second-class citizens. And, you know, I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same. Today, the Saudis are brutally oppressing the poor people in the kingdom, the Shia in eastern Saudi Arabia, and especially the immigrant workers that are often treated as slaves. Sexual slavery flourishes, human trafficking flourishes in Saudi Arabia. The royal family is really a disgrace to Islam and its ideals. And the people of eastern Saudi Arabia are a key element in the mix in Saudi Arabia of justice-seeking people of all persuasions, including some Salafi people, including the poor and the indentured workers and the people who were being mistreated in all these other ways. All of these people, who probably together constitute the majority of the population, really are not happy with the state of things. There have been predictions that the regime in Saudi Arabia is going to fall, going back for decades. It never quite seems to. But I wouldn't be surprised if it finally happens sometime in the next decade.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. That's editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, talking to us from Madison, and U.S. foreign policy and national security analyst Lawrence Korb spoke to us from Washington. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.